anger at the disrespect shown them by the humans made of wood. Trees raged against the humans for their sharp axes, the deer for their arrows, and even the pots made of earth and clay rose up in anger for the times they had been carelessly burnt. All of the misused members of creation rallied together and destroyed the people made of wood in self-defense. Once again, the gods tried to make human beings, but this time purely of light, the sacred energy of the sun. These humans were dazzling to behold, 7 times the color of the sun, beautiful, smart, and very, very powerful. They knew so much that they believed they knew everything. Instead of being grateful to the creators for their gifts, they believed themselves to be the gods' equals. The divine beings understood the danger posed by these people made of light, and once more arranged for their demise. And so the gods tried again to fashion humans who would live right in the beautiful world they had created in respect and gratitude and humility. From 2 baskets of corn, yellow and white, they ground a fine meal, mixed it with water, and shaped a people made of corn. They were fed on corn liquor, and oh, these were good people. They could dance and sing, and they had words to tell stories and offer up prayers. Their hearts were filled with compassion for the rest of creation. They were wise enough to be grateful. The gods had learned their lesson. So to protect the corn people from the overpowering arrogance of their predecessors, the people made of light, they passed a veil before the eyes of the corn people, clouding their vision as breath clouds a mirror. These people of corn are the ones who were respectful and grateful for the world that sustained them, and so they were the people who were sustained upon the earth. Of all the materials, why is it that people of corn would inherit the earth rather than people of mud or wood or light? Could it be that people made of corn are beings transformed? For what is corn, after all, but light transformed by relationship? Corn owes its existence to all 4 elements, earth, air, fire, and water. And corn is the product of relationship not only with the physical world, but with people too. The sacred plant of our origin created people, and people created corn, a great agricultural innovation from its Teosinte ancestor. Corn cannot exist without us to sow it and tend its growth. Our beings are joined in an obligate symbiosis. From these reciprocal acts of creation arise the elements that were missing from the other attempts to create sustainable humanity. Gratitude and a capacity for reciprocity. I've read and loved this story as a history of sorts, a recounting of how, in long ago times, just at the edge of knowing, people were made of maize and lived happily ever after. But in many indigenous ways of knowing, time is not a river, but a lake in which the past, the present, and the future exist. Creation, then, is an ongoing process, and the story is not history alone. It is also prophecy. Have we already become people of corn? Or are we still people made of wood? Are we people made of light, enthralled to our own power? Are we not yet transformed by relationship to earth? Perhaps this story could be a user's manual for understanding how we become people of corn. The Popol Vuh, the Mayan sacred text in which this story is contained, is perceived as more than just a chronicle. As David Suzuki notes in The Wisdom of the Elders, the Mayan stories are understood as an ilbal, a precious seeing instrument or lens with which to view our sacred relationships. He suggests that such stories may offer us a corrective lens. But while our indigenous stories are rich in wisdom, and we need to hear them, I do not advocate their wholesale appropriation. As the world changes, an immigrant culture must write its own new stories of relationship to place, a new ilbal, but tempered by the wisdom of those who were old on this land long before we came. So how, then, can science, art, and story give us a new lens to understand the relationship that people made of corn represent? Someone once said that sometimes a fact alone is a poem. Just so, the people of corn are embedded in a beautiful poem written in the language of chemistry. The first stanza goes like this. Carbon dioxide plus water combined in the presence of light and chlorophyll in the beautiful membrane-bound machinery of life yields sugar and oxygen. Photosynthesis, in other words, in which air, light, and water are combined out of nothingness into sweet morsels of sugar, the stuff of redwoods and daffodils and corn. Straw spun to gold, water turned to wine. Photosynthesis is the link between the inorganic realm and the living world, making the inanimate live. At the same time, it gives us oxygen. Plants give us food and breath. Here is the second stanza, the same as the first, but recited backward. Sugar combined with oxygen in the beautiful membrane-bound machinery of life called the mitochondria yields us right back where we began, carbon dioxide and water. Respiration, the source of energy that lets us farm and dance and speak. The breath of plants gives life to animals, and the breath of animals gives life to plants. My breath is your breath. Your breath is mine. It's the great poem of give and take, of reciprocity that animates the world. Isn't that a story worth telling? Only when people understand the symbiotic relationships that sustain them can they become people of corn, capable of gratitude and reciprocity. The very facts of the world are a poem. Light is turned to sugar. Salamanders find their way to ancestral ponds following magnetic lines radiating from the earth. The saliva of grazing buffalo causes the grass to grow taller. Tobacco seeds germinate when they smell smoke. Microbes in industrial waste can destroy mercury. Aren't these stories we should all know? Who is it that holds them? In long ago times, it was the elders who carried them. In the 21st century, it is often scientists who first hear them. The stories of buffalo and salamanders belong to the land, but scientists are one of their translators and carry a large responsibility for conveying their stories to the world. And yet scientists mostly convey these stories in a language that excludes readers. Conventions for efficiency and precision make reading scientific papers very difficult for the rest of the world, and if the truth be known, for us as well. This has serious consequences for public dialogue about the environment, and therefore for real democracy, especially the democracy of all species. For what good is knowing unless it is coupled with caring? Science can give us knowing, but caring comes from someplace else. I think it's fair to say that if the Western world has an ilbal, it is science. Science lets us see the dance of the chromosomes, the leaves of moss, and the farthest galaxy. But is it a sacred lens, like the Popol Vuh? Does science allow us to perceive the sacred in the world, or does it bend light in such a way as to obscure it? A lens that brings the material world into focus, but blurs the spiritual, is the lens of a people made of wood. It is not more data that we need for our transformation to people of corn, but more wisdom. While science could be a source of and repository for knowledge, the scientific worldview is all too often an enemy of ecological compassion. It is important in thinking about this lens to separate two ideas that are too often synonymous in the mind of the public: the practice of science and the scientific worldview that it feeds. Science is the process of revealing the world through rational inquiry. The practice of doing real science brings the questioner into an unparalleled intimacy with nature, fraught with wonder and creativity as we try to comprehend the mysteries of the more-than-human world. Trying to understand the life of another being or another system so unlike our own is often humbling, and for many scientists is a deeply spiritual pursuit. Contrasting with this is the scientific worldview, in which a culture uses the process of interpreting science in a cultural context that uses science and technology to reinforce reductionist, materialist, economic and political agendas. I maintain that the destructive lens of the people made of wood is not science itself, but the lens of the scientific worldview, the illusion of dominance and control, the separation of knowledge from responsibility. I dream of a world guided by a lens of stories rooted in the revelations of science and framed with an indigenous worldview, stories in which matter and spirit are both given voice. Scientists are particularly good at learning about the lives of other species. The stories they could tell convey the intrinsic values of the lives of other beings, lives every bit as interesting, maybe more so, as those of Homo sapiens. But while scientists are among those who are privy to these other intelligences, many seem to believe that the intelligence they access is only their own. They lack the fundamental ingredient, humility. After the gods experimented with arrogance, they gave the people of corn humility, and it takes humility to learn from other species. In the indigenous view, humans are viewed as somewhat lesser beings in the democracy of species. We are referred to as the younger brothers of creation. So like younger brothers, we must learn from our elders. Plants were here first and have had a long time to figure things out. They live both above and below ground and hold the earth in place. Plants know how to make food from light and water. Not only do they feed themselves, but they make enough to sustain the lives of all of the rest of us. Plants are providers for the rest of the community and exemplify the virtue of generosity, always offering food. What if Western scientists saw plants as their teachers rather than their subjects? What if they told stories with that lens? Many indigenous peoples share the understanding that we are each endowed with a particular gift, a unique ability. Birds to sing and stars to glitter, for instance. It is understood that these gifts have a dual nature, though. A gift is also a responsibility. If the bird's gift is song, then it has a responsibility to greet the day with music. It is the duty of birds to sing, and the rest of us receive the song as a gift. Asking what is our responsibility is perhaps also to ask, what is our gift, and how shall we use it? Stories like the one about the people of Korn give us guidance, both to recognize the world as gift and to think about how we might respond. The people of mud and wood and light all lacked gratitude and the sense of reciprocity that flowed from it. It was only the people of Korn, people transformed by awareness of their gifts and responsibilities, who were sustained on the earth. Gratitude comes first, but gratitude alone is not enough. Other beings are known to be especially gifted, with attributes that humans lack. Other beings can fly, see at night, rip open trees with their claws, make maple syrup. What can humans do? We may not have wings or leaves, but we humans do have words. Language is our gift and our responsibility. I've come to think of writing as an act of reciprocity with the living land. Words to remember old stories. Words to tell new ones. Stories that bring science and spirit back together to nurture our becoming people made of Korn. Collateral damage. The headlights throw two beams through the fog from a long way off as the car winds toward us. The rise and fall of the lights has become our signal to dash into the road, grabbing up one soft black body in each hand. The beams appear and disappear in the dips and curves as we shuttle back and forth with flashlight beams speckling the pavement. When we hear the engine, we know there is only time for one last run before the car crests the hill and bears down upon us. Standing on the shoulder, I can see faces as the car draws near, greenish in the dashboard lights, looking right at us as the spray from the tires flies up. Our eyes meet, and the brake lights flash red for just a heartbeat, lit up like momentary synapses in the driver's brain. The light telegraphs a hint of thought for fellow humans in the rain on the side of a lonely country road. I'm waiting for them to roll down a window and ask if we need help, but they don't stop. The driver looks back over his shoulder, brake lights dimming as he speeds away. If cars scarcely break for Homo sapiens, what hope can we hold for Ambystoma maculata, our other neighbors who travel this road in the night? Rain beats against my kitchen window in the falling dusk. I can hear geese outside in low formation over the valley. Winter is letting go. Pausing by the stove with raincoats draped over my arm, I stop to stir a pot of pea soup, sending up clouds of steam that mist over the window. We'll be glad for a warm cup during the night ahead. The 6 o'clock news comes on while I am headfirst in the closet, rounding up flashlights. It has begun. Bombs are falling on Baghdad tonight. I stop in the middle of the floor, listening, with my hands full of boots, a red pair and a black. Somewhere, another woman looks out her window, but the formation of dark shapes in her sky is not a skein of spring geese returning. Skies billowing with smoke, homes alight, sirens wailing. CNN reports the number of sorties and tons of ordnance, like box scores in a baseball game. The level of collateral damage, they say, is as yet unknown. Collateral damage. Shielding words to keep us from naming the consequences of a missile gone astray. The words ask us to turn our faces away, as if man-made destruction were an inescapable fact of nature. collateral damage measured in overturned soup pots and wailing children. Heavy with helplessness, I turn off the radio and call my family to supper. When the dishes are done, we slip into raincoats, then out into the night, driving the back roads to Labrador Hollow. While it rains bombs on Baghdad, the first rain of spring falls on our valley. Soft and steady, it penetrates the forest floor, melting away the last of the ice crystals beneath the winter-weary blanket of leaves. The splatter and splash is a welcome sound after the long silence of snow. To a salamander beneath a log, the first heavy raindrops must sound like the knuckles of spring knocking hard on the door overhead. After 6 months of torpor, stiff limbs slowly flex, tails wiggle out of winter immobility, and within minutes, snouts, nose upward, and legs push away cold earth as the salamanders crawl up into the night. The rain washes away traces of clinging soil and polishes their smooth black skin. The land is waking up, rising to the call of rain. After we pull off the road and get out of the car, the quiet is stunning in the wake of swishing windshield wipers and the defroster going full tilt. The warm rain on cold earth has raised a ground fog, wrapping around the bare trees. Our voices are muffled in the mist. Our flashlights diffuse into warm halos. Here in upstate New York, flocks of geese mark the change of seasons, noisily making their way from winter safety to the breeding grounds of spring. Largely unseen, but equally dramatic, is the migration of salamanders from winter burrows to the vernal pools where they will meet their mates. The first warm rain of spring, a soaking rain coinciding with the temperature above 42 degrees, sets the forest floor to rustling and stirring, and mass they rise from the hidden places, blink at the open air, and start on their way. This outpouring of animals is nearly invisible, unless you happen to be in a swamp on a rainy spring night. Salamanders move when darkness protects them from predators and rain keeps their skin moist, and they move by the thousands, like a herd of sluggish buffalo. Like the buffalo, too, their numbers diminish each year. Like its nearby cousins, the Finger Lakes, Labrador Pond lies in the bottom of a V-shaped valley, flanked by two steep hills left behind by the last glacier. The forested slopes curve around the pond like the sides of a bowl, funneling amphibians from the woods of the entire watershed straight to the water. But their route is interrupted by a road that snakes through the hollow. The pond and surrounding hills are protected as state forest, but the road is a free-for-all. We walk down the deserted road, scanning our lights back and forth over the pavement. Salamanders aren't the only ones on the move tonight. Wood frogs, bullfrogs, green frogs, leopard frogs, and newts also hear the call and begin their annual journey. There are toads, peepers, red efts, and legions of tree frogs, all with mating on their minds. The road is a circus of jumps and leaps flashing in and out of our flashlights. My beam catches the glittering gold of an eye. The peeper freezes as I approach and then hops away. Ahead of us, the road is alive with frogs leaping across, two here in my light, three over there, bounding toward the pond. With their prodigious leaps, they cross the road in just a few seconds. Not so the heavy-bodied salamanders, who belly their way across the road. Their journey takes about 2 minutes, and in 2 minutes, anything can happen. Spotting the lumbering forms among the frogs, we stop and pick them up, one after the other, carefully setting them on the other side of the road. We walk back and forth between the passage of cars over the same small stretch, and each time we look, there are more. The land seems to be releasing salamanders as numerous as the geese rising off a marsh. I run my light across the road, and the center line reflects bright yellow against the rain-black asphalt. In the corner of my eye, there's something darker than dark, a break in reflection off the pavement that draws my light back to that spot. The shadow resolves into a big spotted salamander, Ambystoma maculata, black and yellow like the road. The shape is so primitive, with right-angle limbs jutting from the side and moving with a jerky mechanical motion across the road, dragging a thick tail in a sinuous side-to-side wave behind it. When it stops in the circle of my light, I reach out to touch its skin, blue-black, like night congealed. The body is splotched with opaque yellow, like drops of paint on a wet surface, blurred at the edges. Its wedge-shaped head swings from side to side, blunt snout with eyes so dark they disappear into its face. By its size, about 7 inches long, and its swollen sides, I'd guess this is a female. I wonder what it feels like to drag that tender skin with a smooth, soft belly made for sliding over wet leaves across the asphalt. I stoop to pick her up, circling my two fingers just behind her front legs. There is surprisingly little resistance. It's like picking up an overripe banana. My fingers sink into her body, cold and soft and wet. I gently set her down on the shoulder and wipe my hands on my pants. Without a backward glance, she lunges over the embankment, down to the pond. The females are the first to arrive. Heavy with eggs, they will slide into the shallows and disappear among the decaying leaves on the bottom. They wait, fecund and sluggish in the cold water, for the males, who will make the same journey down from the hillsides a day or two later. They come out from under logs and across streams, all pointed in the same direction, the pool where they were born. Their route is circuitous because they don't have the ability to climb over obstacles. They follow along the edges of any log or rock until it ends and they are free to go forward onto the pond. The natal pond may be as much as half a mile from their wintering spot, and yet they locate it unerringly. Salamanders have a guidance system easily as complex as the smart bombs winding their way to targets in Iraqi neighborhoods tonight. Without the benefit of satellite or microchip, salamanders navigate by a combination of magnetic and chemical signals that herpetologists are just beginning to understand. Part of their direction-finding ability relies on a precise reading of the lines in the Earth's magnetic field. A small organ in the brain processes magnetic data and guides the salamander to its pond. Though many other ponds and vernal pools lie along the route, they will not stop until they arrive at the birthplace, struggling mightily to get there. Once they are close, homing in salamanders seems to be similar to salmon identifying their home river. They smell their way with a nasal gland on their snouts. Following the Earth's magnetic signals gets them to the neighborhood, and then scent takes over to guide them home. It's like getting off an airplane and then finding your way to your childhood home by following the ineffable odor of Sunday dinner and your mother's perfume. On last year's mission to the Hollow, my daughter begged to follow the salamanders and see where they were going. We trailed behind by flashlight as the amphibians twined between scarlet stems of red osier and clambered over flattened tussocks of sedge. They stopped far short of the main pond, on the edges of a vernal pool, a small depression in the land that goes unnoticed in summer but reliably fills with snowmelt every spring, making a watery mosaic. Salamanders choose these temporary basins to lay eggs. Because they are too shallow and short-lived for fish, which would gobble up the salamander larvae to inhabit. The pool's evanescence is the newborn's protection from fish. We followed the salamanders to the water's edge, where platelets of ice still clung to the shore. They did not hesitate, but strode purposefully into the water and disappeared. My daughter was disappointed, expecting to see them loitering on the beach or doing belly flops into the pool. She searched the water's surface with her flashlight, wanting to see what happened next. But there were only dappled leaves on the bottom of the pool, patches of light and dark. Nothing to see, until we realized that the patches of light and dark were not leaves at all, but the black and yellow spots of dozens of salamanders. Everywhere the light stopped, there were salamanders, the bottom of the pool a blanket of animals. And they were moving, swirling about each other like a roomful of dancers. Compared to their ponderous movement on land, they were fleet in the water, swimming as gracefully as seals. One flick of the tail, and they were gone from the circle of light. The glassy surface of the pond was suddenly broken from below, like the upwelling of a surging spring, and the water started to churn as they moved together in a roiling crowd, yellow spots flashing. We stood in amazed witness to their mating ritual, a congress of salamanders. As many as 50 males and females danced and swirled together, a rapturous celebration after a long year of solitary, celibate existence, eating bugs under a log. Bubbles rose from the bottom of the pond like champagne. Unlike most amphibians, Ambystoma maculata does not spill its eggs and sperm freely into the water for a frenzy of mass fertilization. The species has evolved a more probable scheme to ensure the meeting of egg and sperm. Males break away from the dancing swarm, take a gulp of air, and swim for the bottom of the pond, where they release a glistening spermatophore, a gelatinous sack of sperm, with a stalk to attach it to a twig or a leaf. The females then leave the dance and seek out the quarter-inch sacks, which hover like shiny mylar balloons bobbing in the water. They draw the spermatophores into an internal cavity where eggs are waiting. Safely inside, the sperm are then released from the sac and fertilize the pearly eggs. A few days later, each female will lay a mass of 100 to 200 eggs in a gelatinous mass. The expectant mother will linger nearby until the eggs hatch, but then she returns, alone, to the woods. The newborn salamanders stay behind, in the safety of the pool for several months, metamorphosing until they are capable of life on land. By the time the pool has dried up and forced them out, their gills will be replaced by lungs, and they are ready to forage on their own. The juvenile salamanders, or newts, are wanderers who will not return to the pond until they are sexually mature, 4 to 5 years later. Salamanders can be long-lived beings. Adults may make the mating migration through a lifetime as long as 18 years, but only if they can cross the road. Amphibians are one of the most vulnerable groups on the planet. Subject to habitat loss as wetlands and forests disappear, amphibians are the collateral damage we blindly accept as the cost of development. And because amphibians breathe through their skin, they have little ability to filter out toxins at that moist membrane between animal and atmosphere. Even when their habitats are safe from industry, their atmosphere may not be. Toxins in the air and water, acid rain, heavy metals, and synthetic hormones all end up in the water in which they gestate. Developmental abnormalities, like six-legged frogs and twisted salamanders, are now found throughout the industrialized world. Tonight, the salamander's biggest threat is the cars that go speeding by, their occupants unaware of the spectacle that is taking place beneath their tires. From inside the car, listening to late-night radio, you just don't know. But standing on the roadside, you can hear the pop of the body, hear the moment when a glistening being following magnetic trails toward love is reduced to red pulp on the pavement. We try to work faster, but there are so many, and we are so few. A green Dodge pickup I recognize races by, and we stand back on the shoulder. It was one of my neighbors who has a dairy farm just up the road, but he doesn't even see us. I suspect his thoughts are far away tonight, straining toward Baghdad. His son, Mitch, is stationed in Iraq. Mitch is a nice kid, the kid who, with a friendly wave, would always pull his slow tractor off to the roadside to let cars pass safely. I suppose he's driving a tank now. The fate of salamanders crossing the road in his old hometown might seem completely unconnected to the scene he faces. Tonight, though, when the fog wraps us all in the same cold blanket, the edges seem to blur. The carnage on this dark country road and the broken bodies on the streets of Baghdad do seem connected. Salamanders, children, young farmers in uniform, they are not the enemy or the problem. We have not declared war on these innocents, and yet they die just as surely as if we had. They are all collateral damage. If it is oil that sends the suns to war, and oil that fuels the engines that roar down this hollow, then we are all complicit. Soldiers, civilians, and salamanders connected in death by our appetite for oil. Cold and tired, we stop and pour out a cup of soup from the thermos. Its steam rises to mingle with the fog. We sip quietly and listen to the night. Suddenly I hear voices, but there are no houses nearby. Up around the curve, I catch the strobes of other flashlights. I quickly shut off my light and close up the thermos. We back away into shadow and watch as the lights come nearer, a whole line of them. Who would be out on a night like this? Only someone out looking for trouble, and I don't want to be it. Kids use this road sometimes as a drinking spot, a place to shoot beer cans. I once saw a pair of young men kicking a toad between them like a hacky sack. I shudder to think what brings them here. The lights are closer now, at least a dozen, all scattered across the road like a patrol. The beams scan back and forth over the road. As they come closer, the pattern of their lights becomes oddly familiar. It is the very same pattern we've been making all night. And then I hear their voices through the fog. Look, here's another one, a female. Hey, I got two over here. Add three peepers. Grinning in the dark, I switch on my light again and step out to meet them as they bend and carry the salamanders to safety. We are so glad to see each other, and we pump each other's hands as our voices rise in laughter around a virtual campfire made by flashlights. I pour out soup for everybody, and we are all momentarily bound together with the giddiness of relief, both to know that the approaching lights are friend and not foe, and to recognize that we are not alone in our efforts. We all introduce ourselves and get a look at the faces under the dripping hoods. Our fellow travelers are students from a herpetology class at the college. They all have clipboards and write-in-the-rain notebooks to record their observations. I feel embarrassed to have assumed they were troublemakers. Ignorance makes it too easy to jump to conclusions about what we don't understand. The class is here to study the effects of roads on amphibians. They tell us that frogs and toads take only about 15 seconds to cross the road and mostly escape the cars. The spotted salamanders average 88 seconds. They may have evaded countless predators, survived a summer drought, endured the winter without freezing, but it all comes down to 88 seconds. The students' efforts on behalf of Ambystoma go beyond roadside rescue. The highway department could install salamander crossings, special culverts that allow the animals to avoid the road. But they're expensive, and the authorities need to be convinced of their importance. The class mission tonight is to take a census of the amphibians crossing the road to estimate the total number of animals who move from the hills to the pond and the number who die en route. If they can get adequate data to show that road deaths endanger the viability of this population, then they may be able to persuade the state to take action. There's just one problem. In order to obtain accurate estimates of salamander mortality, they have to count both the animals who make it across the road and those who don't. It turns out that tallying death is easy. They've developed a system for identifying the species of animal by the size of the blotch it leaves on the road, which is then scraped up to avoid counting it again on the next traverse of the road. Sometimes death occurs even without collision. Salamanders are so soft-bodied that merely the pressure wave generated by a passing vehicle can be fatal. The missing number is the denominator of the death equation, the number of animals who do make it safely across. How can they take inventory of the successful crossings on a long stretch of road in total darkness? At widely spaced intervals along the road, drift fences have been installed. A drift fence is simply a length of snow fence, about 8 feet long, with a foot-high strip of aluminum roof flashing, wired like a wall along its base. The salamanders can't wiggle through. Confronting this obstacle, they edge along the drift fence as if it were a log or a rock. They attempt to follow it to its end, slithering along in the darkness, moving by feel of the fence against skin, until suddenly the ground vanishes and they fall into a buried plastic bucket from which they cannot escape. The students come along every so often and count the animals in the bucket, record the species on their clipboards, and then gently release them on the other side of the fence on their way to the pond. At night's end, the number of animals caught by the drift fences provides an estimate of the number who safely crossed the road. These studies may provide the evidence that will save the salamanders. But there is a short-term cost to that long-term benefit. In order to do the research properly, no human intervention is allowed. When a car is coming, the students have to stand back, grit their teeth, and let it happen. Our well-intentioned salamander rescues have in fact biased the experiment tonight, as we decreased the number who normally would have been hit, causing an underestimate in the serious losses that occur. It poses an ethical dilemma for the students. The dead who could have been saved become the collateral damage of the study, a sacrifice that they hope will pay off in future protection for the species. This roadkill monitoring is the project of James Gibbs, an internationally renowned conservation biologist. He is a leader in conserving Galapagos tortoises and Tanzanian toads, but his concerns are also here in Labrador Hollow. He and his students set up the drift fences, patrol the road, and stay up all night counting. Gibbs confesses that sometimes on rainy nights when he knows the salamanders are moving and dying, he can't sleep. He puts on a raincoat and goes out to carry them across. Aldo Leopold had it right. Naturalists live in a world of wounds that only they can see. As night deepens, there are no more headlights twisting down the hollow. By midnight, even the slowest salamander can cross in safety. So we trudge back to the car and head for home, driving at a snail's pace until we're out of the hollow, lest our own wheels undo our work. We're painfully careful, but I know we're as guilty as anyone. Driving home through the fog, we hear more war news on the radio. Columns of tanks and Bradley fighting vehicles are advancing over the Iraqi countryside through a sandstorm as dense as the fog that shrouds us here. I wonder what is crushed beneath them as they pass. Cold and tired, I crank up the heater and the car fills with the smell of wet wool. I think back on our night's work and the good people we met. What is it that drew us to the hollow tonight? What crazy kind of species is it that leaves a warm home on a rainy night to ferry salamanders across a road? It's tempting to call it altruism, but it's not. There is nothing selfless about it. This night heaps rewards on the givers as well as the recipients. We get to be there, to witness this amazing rite, and for an evening, to enter into a relationship with other beings as different from ourselves as we can imagine. It has been said that people of the modern world suffer a great sadness, a species loneliness, estrangement from the rest of creation. We have built this isolation with our fear, with our arrogance, and with our homes brightly lit against the night. For a moment as we walked this road, those barriers dissolved, and we began to relieve the loneliness and know each other once again. Salamanders are so very much the other, cold, slimy creatures verging on repulsive to the warm-blooded Homo sapiens. Their startling otherness makes it all the more remarkable that we are here tonight in their defense. Amphibians offer few of the warm, fuzzy feelings that fuel our protection of charismatic mammals that look back at us with Bambi's grateful eyes. They bring us face to face with our innate xenophobia, sometimes directed at other species and sometimes directed at our own, whether in this hollow or in deserts halfway around the globe. Being with salamanders gives honor to otherness, offers an antidote to the poison of xenophobia. Each time we rescue slippery, spotted beings, we attest to their right to be, to live in the sovereign territory of their own lives. Carrying salamanders to safety also helps us remember the covenant of reciprocity, the mutual responsibility that we have for each other. As the perpetrators of the war zone on this road, are we not bound to heal the wounds that we inflict? The news makes me feel powerless. I can't stop bombs from falling, and I can't stop cars from speeding down this road. It is beyond my power. But I can pick up salamanders. For one night, I want to clear my name. What is it that draws us to this lonely hollow? Maybe it is love, the same thing that draws the salamanders from under their logs. Or maybe we walked this road tonight in search of absolution. As the temperature drops, single voices, clear and hollow, replace the keening chorus, the ancient speech of frogs. One word becomes clear, as if spoken in English. Here, here, here. The world is more than your thoughtless commute. We, the collateral, are your wealth, your teachers, your security, your family. Your strange hunger for ease should not mean a death sentence for the rest of creation. Here, calls a peeper in the headlights. Here, calls a young man trapped in a tank far from home. Here, calls a mother whose home is now a burnt-out ruin. There must be an end to this. By the time I get home, it is late, and I cannot sleep. So I walk up the hill to the pond behind my house. Here, too, the air is ringing with their calls. I want to light a sweetgrass smudge to wash away the sadness in a cloud of smoke. But the fog is too heavy, and the matches just bleed a red streak on the box. As it should be. There should be no washing away tonight. Better to wear the grief like a sodden coat. Weep, weep, calls a toad from the water's edge. And I do. If grief can be a doorway to love, then let us all weep for the world we are breaking apart, so we can love it back to wholeness again. Shkatagan, people of the seventh fire. So much depends on the lighting of this fire, so neatly laid on the cold ground and circled round by stones. A platform of dry maple kindling, a floor of fine twiglets snapped from the underside of a fir, a nest of shredded bark ready for the coal over which broken pine branches are balanced to draw a flame upward. Plenty of fuel, plenty of oxygen, all the elements are in place. But without the spark, it is only a pile of dead sticks. So much depends on the spark. It was a point of pride in my family that we learned to light a fire with a single match. My father was our teacher, along with the woods themselves, and we learned without lessons, by playing and watching and wanting to emulate his comfort in wild places. He patiently showed us how to search out the right materials. Incrementally, we observed the architecture that would feed the flame. He put great store in a fine woodpile, and many of our days in the woods were spent felling, hauling, and splitting. Firewood warms you twice, he would always say, as we emerged from the woods hot and sweaty. In the doing of it, we learned to recognize the trees by their bark, by their wood, and by the way they burned for different purposes. Pitchy pine for light, beech for a bed of coals, sugar maples to bake pies in the reflector oven. He never said so directly, but fire making was more than just a woodscraft skill. To build a good fire, a person had to work. There were high standards. No piece of half-rotten birch was permitted in his woodpile. Punky, he would say, and toss it aside. Knowledge of the flora was a given, as was respectful treatment of the woods, so that you gathered without doing harm. There was always plenty of standing dead wood there for the taking, already dry and seasoned. Only natural materials went into a good fire. No paper, or heaven forbid gasoline. And green wood was an affront to both aesthetics and ethics. No lighters allowed. We earned high praise for the ideal one-match fire, but plenty of encouragement if we needed a dozen. And at some point, it became natural and easy, no feat at all. I found a secret that always worked for me, to sing to the fire as I touched the match to tinder. Woven into my dad's fire teachings was appreciation for all the woods gave us, and a sense of our responsibility for reciprocity. We never left a camping place without leaving a pile of wood for the next people on the trail. Paying attention, being prepared and patient, and doing it right the first time. The skill and the values were so closely entwined that fire making became for us an emblem of a certain kind of virtue. Once we mastered the one match fire, then came the one match fire in the rain and the snow. With the right materials carefully assembled and respect for the ways of air and wood, you could always have a fire. The power of that simple act, with a single match, you could make people feel safe and happy, convert a bunch of sodden individuals into a convivial group thinking of stew and songs. It was an amazing gift to carry in your pocket, and a serious responsibility to be used well. Fire building was a vital connection to those who came before. Potawatomi, or more accurately, Bodwewadmi in our language, means people of the fire. It seemed only right that this was a skill we should master, a gift to share. I began to think that to really understand fire, I needed a bow drill in my hand. Now I try to make a no-match fire, to conjure a coal in the old way, with bow and drill, a friction fire, rubbing two sticks together. Wewe ne, I say to myself, in a good time, in a good way. There are no shortcuts. It must unfold in the right way, when all the elements are present, mind and body harnessed in unison, when all the tools have been properly made, and all the parts united in purpose. It is so easy. But if they're not, it will be futile. Until there is balance and perfect reciprocity between the forces, you can try and fail, and try and fail again. I know. And yet, despite the need, you must swallow your sense of urgency, calm your breathing, so that the energy goes not to frustration, but to fire. After we were all grown up and fully fire competent, my father made sure his grandchildren could also light a one-match fire. At 83, he teaches fire building at our Native Youth Science Camp, sharing the same lessons he gave us. They have a race to have their little blazes burn through a string stretched across the fire circle. One day, after the contest has been won, he sits on a stump poking at the fire. "Did you know," he asks them, "that there are four kinds of fire?" I am expecting his lesson on hardwoods and softwoods, but there's something else on his mind. "Well, first, of course, there's this campfire you made. You can cook on it, keep warm next to it. It's a good place to sing, and it keeps the coyotes away. And toast marshmallows," pipes up one of the kids. "You bet. And bake potatoes, make bannock. You can cook most anything on a campfire." "Who knows the other kinds of fire?" he asks. "Forest fires?" one of the students tries tentatively. "Sure," he says. "What the people used to call thunderbird fires, forest fires ignited by lightning. Sometimes they'd get put out by the rain, but sometimes they could turn into huge wildfires. They could be so hot they'd destroy everything for miles around. Nobody likes that kind of fire. But our people learned to set fires that were small and in just the right place and time so that they helped rather than hurt. The people set these fires on purpose to take care of the land, to help the blueberries grow or to make meadows for deer. He holds up a sheet of birch bark. In fact, look at all that birch bark you used in your fire. Young paper birches only grow up after fire. So our ancestors burned forest to create clearings for birch. The symmetry of using fire to create fire-building materials was not lost on them. They needed birch bark, so they used their own fire science to create birch forests. Fires help out a lot of plants and animals. We're told that's why the Creator gave people the fire stick, to bring good things to the land. A lot of the time you hear people say that the best thing people can do for nature is to stay away from it and let it be. There are places where that's absolutely true, and our people respected that. But we were also given the responsibility to care for land. What people forget is that that means participating, that the natural world relies on us to do good things. You don't show your love and care by putting what you love behind a fence. You have to be involved. You have to contribute to the well-being of the world. The land gives us so many gifts. Fire is a way we can give back. In modern times, the public thinks fire is only destructive, but they've forgotten, or simply never knew, how people used fire as a creative force. The fire stick was like a paintbrush on the landscape. Touch it here in a small dab, and you've made a green meadow for elk. A light scatter there burns off the brush, so the oaks make more acorns. Stipple it under the canopy, and it thins the stand to prevent catastrophic fire. Draw the fire brush along the creek, and the next spring, it's a thick stand of yellow willows. A wash over a grassy meadow turns it blue with camas. To make blueberries, let the paint dry for a few years, and repeat. Our people were given the responsibility to use fire to make things beautiful and productive. It was our art and our science. The birch forests maintained by indigenous burning were a cornucopia of gifts. Bark for canoes, sheathing for wigwams, and tools and baskets, scrolls for writing, and of course tinder for fires. But these are only the obvious gifts. Both paper birch and yellow birch are hosts to the fungus Inanotus obliquus, which erupts through the bark to form sterile conchs, a fruiting body that looks like a grainy black tumor the size of a softball. Its surface is cracked and crusted, studded with cinders as if it had been burnt. Known to people of the Siberian birch forests as chaga, it is a valued traditional medicine. Our people call it shkatagan. It takes some effort to find a black knob of shkatagan and then dislodge it from the tree. But cut open, the body of the conch is banded in glowing shades of gold and bronze, with the texture of spongy wood, all constructed of tiny threads and air-filled pores. Our ancestors discovered a remarkable property of this being, although some say it spoke its own use to us through its burnt exterior and golden heart. Shkatagan is a tinder fungus, a firekeeper, and a good friend to the people of the fire. Once an ember meets shkatagan, it will not go out, but smolder slowly in the fungal matrix, holding its heat. Even the smallest spark, so fleeting and easily lost, will be held and nurtured if it lands on a cube of shkatagan. And yet as forests are felled and fire suppression jeopardizes species that depend on burned ground, it's getting harder and harder to find. Okay. What are the other kinds of fire, my father asks, as he adds a stick to the fire at his feet. Dayodaraga knows. Sacred fire, like for ceremonies. Of course, my dad says. The fires we use to carry prayers, for healing, for sweat lodges. That fire represents our life, the spiritual teachings that we've had from the very beginning. The sacred fire is the symbol of life and spirit, so we have special fire keepers to care for them. You might not get to be around those other fires very often, he said, but there's fire you must tend to every day. The hardest one to take care of is the one right here, he says, tapping his finger against his chest. Your own fire, your spirit. We all carry a piece of that sacred fire within us. We have to honor it and care for it. You are the firekeeper. Now remember that you're responsible for all those kinds of fire, he reminds them. That's our job, especially we men. In our way, there is balance between men and women. Men are responsible for caring for fire, and women are responsible for water. Those two forces balance each other out. We need both to live. Now here's something you can't forget about fire, he says. As he stands before the kids, I hear echoes of the first teachings, when Nana Bojo received the same fire teachings from his father that my dad is passing on today. You must always remember that fire has two sides. Both are very powerful. One side is the force of creation. Fire can be used for good, like on your hearth or in ceremony. Your own heart fire is also a force for good. But that same power can be turned to destruction. Fire can be good for the land, but it can also destroy. Your own fire can be used for ill, too. Human people can never forget to understand and respect both sides of this power. They are far stronger than we are. We must learn to be careful,